Table instead of sitting back. I'm Ken Kirky, Planning Director at MTC. At MTC and ABAG staff, Ezra is here, I see. We welcome you to this first Regional Advisory Working Group meeting of 2015 and really the first one kicking off the update of Plan Bay Area. First, I just want to say we really do appreciate you taking your time to make your way to Oakland on a relatively wintry morning. By our standards here in the Bay Area. Your input was really, really valuable when we did the plan, and as we move toward the update of the plan in 2017, we expect it will be again. As in the past, we'll have a series of presentations, lots of time for discussion after each presentation. Everyone is invited to share their thoughts. There's no limit on the amount of time you would like to speak. As a general rule, we'd like to hear from local agency representatives first as the implementing agencies of the plan. And we do request that everyone attending the meeting treat everyone else with civility. That's an expectation for all of these meetings going forward. So with that, I'd like to first we can go around the room and have introductions. If you could give us your name and if you're representing an entity, what that entity is. And I guess I'll go to my left.
Good morning. My name is Ezra Rapport with the Association of Bay Area Governments.
Darren Randoletti with the City of Oakland. I don't think I'm actually on the group, but I'm taking your invitation to sit at the table. So thank you, Ken, with the Planning Department and Rachel back there. She's our Director of Planning at Oakland.
Uri Pachter, Greenbelt Alliance. I'm filling in for Stephanie Reyes.
Vanessa Love, the SFCTA.
Amber Cobb, also with the SFCTA.
Marcella Renzi, Santa Clara VTA.
Diane Steinhaus with the Transportation Authority in Marin.
Derek McGill, Planning Manager for the Transportation Authority of Marin.
Carmella Campbell, Planning Manager, City of Union City.
Brent Cooper, Community Development Director, City of American Canyon.
I'm Mike McCann with the Contra Costa County Health Department.
Chris Barney with the Sonoma County Transportation Authority.
Sarwana Sundra with Alameda County Transportation Commission.
Aaron Acknin, Community Development Director with the City of Redwood City.
Margaret Kavanaugh Lynch, Development Service Manager, City of El Cerrito.
Adam Nolting with the MTC Planning Department.
And Cynthia Kroll, I'm ABAG's Chief Economist.
Over here. Ellen?
Hi, Ellen Griffin, MTC.
Teresa Ramel, MTC.
Tom Buckley, MTC.
Mike Riley, MTC Planning.
Great. Thank you very much. I just received an important update that coffee is on the way, so stay tuned for that. And Dwayne Bay.
Dwayne Bay, ABAG. Good morning.
So our first item is a brief overview of the Plan Bay Area update schedule, what it looks like going up through the spring of 2017, and Adam Nolting is going to kick that off.
Good morning. Included in your agenda materials were three different handouts, and I'll cover these in the presentation that I'm about to go through. The Plan Bay Area schedule initiates essentially in July or May of this coming year. But one of the first things that we're working through is our public participation plan. So any of the materials we're presenting this morning are simply draft and are actually available. You can look online and comment on our proposed approach to the plan and everything else. And I'll give you some more materials on that, where you can do that as well. But I guess I'll start off by going back. In July of last year, the MTC and ABAG staff presented to its joint planning committee a proposed approach to the plan. This material is a handout in your materials, as it's shown as Attachment A. It's the second page beyond your pink or salmon-colored worksheet. It's in a table format, and it starts with the proposed approach, overall approach, as well as some specific tasks. But I guess one of the key things I wanted to emphasize in this was simply that through all the materials we've talked about at this point, the intention on the plan update is really to be a focused update in 2017. Again, we did just approve the plan in 2013, so this is really looking at a proposed update just to the overall framework of the Plan Bay Area. So again, what we'll talk about a little bit this morning is just our draft proposal as of this point. So as you can see on the slide in front of you, one of the emphasis is really just maintaining the performance framework of the last plan. That was one of the points I think there was a lot of emphasis on maintaining that moving forward. And so, and also we know there are a lot of new initiatives out there. There are some new projects from countywide transportation plans. There are some other initiatives through goods movement projects, as well as core capacity transit projects, and a number of others. So we know those initiatives are out there, and we want to be able to try to incorporate those into the next plan. We also know there are some other initiatives out there too, sea level rise, and as well as other different types of initiatives that we will try to incorporate. And some of these were identified in the conclusion of the last plan, but due to the timing, we've spent a little more emphasis over the last few months and years, I guess, looking at trying to incorporate that those aspects into the next plan. In addition, there were some requirements per some settlement agreements that we'll be adding to the plan as well. So these are some of the proposed approaches that we discussed in the planning committee in July. There's some other specific tasks, but I guess where we are today is looking at our draft public participation plan, which is available online on the MTC website. The materials on the slide are shown on the second handout of your materials, which is the 11x17 Plan Bay Area Update Key Milestones 2014 to 2017. I've broken this 11x17 worksheet into two different slides. I'm just emphasizing that we've identified really some major key categories with some policy elements which really focus on our goals and performance targets, as well as regional forecasts, performance, project performance, scenario analysis, and the final plan and development. So the Appendix A of the Public Participation Plan, again, which is all for draft, as well as all of this material, is online. This really focuses on the 2017 update. So what our intention with the Appendix A is to really identify the significance and impact of these key milestones and how they're related to each other, as well as identify opportunities for public input and comment on each of the different milestones. And finally, we wanted to identify some roles and responsibilities of the different key agencies and working groups, advisory committees, and what their responsibilities were for offering input into the plan. So that's all in there. Again, these are all draft. These are still up for comment. So you're able to review all those materials and offer comments back to us. But the real emphasis, I think, here is looking at the key milestones and the dates. And I know on the slide presentation in front of you, it's probably a little bit difficult to see. I think in the handout materials, it's a little larger picture. But we're initiating really the plan in the spring, as well as, again, around the time of May. I think our intention at this point, again, as a draft, is to go have some initial public workshops as of May of this calendar year, where we'd begin talking about some goals and performance targets in the following months. And Cynthia is going to be talking about the regional forecast a little bit later on your agenda, but that's obviously a very key component of the plan update, and she'll be covering the methodology and other aspects. But we also know that's going to be kicking off now. As you can see on your agenda, we have some in your materials, the calendar, we have a February is the regional forecast approach, moving into the methodology as of in the summer with a final forecast in January. So that's another one of those key critical components I know most of you are interested in. In addition is the call for projects, which is where we're looking for information from the project sponsors about projects for inclusion in the plan. I think our intention has been discussed as again, going back to this update to Plan Bay Area. So we're focused on really updating project information, but we do know there's going to be some new projects, so that we will be trying to incorporate that as well. And as pointed out before, the project performance assessment is certainly one of the critical components we want to maintain. So that will be continuing likely in the fall, beginning around September through January of 2016. So I know I've kind of walked through some of these things really critically, that are very critical components, rather quickly, but I wanted to just keep in mind that these are still draft. There is some flexibility in these. So if we do comments back, there likely could be changes moving forward. Another aspect that we talk a lot about is the scenario development for the plan. So those approach would be getting, again, in the summer as well. So there's a lot of things that are overlapping in the development of the plan. And we certainly would like some input into moving those pieces forward. So our overall strategy, again, is to have a preferred scenario adopted in June of 2016, which seems like it's a little bit of ways away, but if we kick off the summer, it's about a year of work to get everything completed, where we would then begin a draft EIR and the document draft as well, which would we would like to have a draft available for public comment the following January, which would be January of 2017, with our final adoption in June of 2017. So we've tried to lay everything out fairly clearly in our key milestones worksheet. Again, if you have any questions or comments for us, we'd be happy to try to address those now. But keep in mind, these are still draft as part of our public participation plan. And once the public participation plan is finalized, we would then move into the plan update process. But we do need to make sure that our public participation plan has been adopted before we begin the overall process. So there's a couple different pieces of the public participation plan. I guess I'll just go back to not only do we have the key milestones that we've just talked about, we also have this chart that talks about roles and responsibilities. And this is just our attempt to identify the same major milestones in which committees or working groups and who are the decision makers and what role other groups would have. So we've identified, as you can see, I think in this is also in your packet materials on the third page, identified as Attachment B, Roles and Responsibilities. The Regional Advisory Working Group has a black solid dot almost on every single task that we've identified, which means we are looking for to the ROG Working Group as an input for the plan development. So keep that in mind as we're moving forward, as we start looking at these different tasks, that we will be coming to you with a lot of different topics, everything from goals, performance targets, to regional forecast, project performance, and scenario analysis, as well as the draft plan. So that is our intention, is to bring all these activities to you for your input. And I guess just to, I was going to try to keep this rather brief, so I'll wrap up a little bit now. But again, as I've tried to reiterate a few different times, is that we do have the draft public participation plan. The deadline for comments are on January 12th, which is next Monday. But you can email comments to us, you can mail them to us, or you can fax them to us. There's a link shown on the slide and the screen. It's also on the MTC website. I think these have been mailed out, or you've probably been notified about the draft plan. I think it's been posted for a number of days now. But please comment if you have any questions. Specific questions, feel free to comment and let us know. But with that, I guess I would just open it up if there's any questions regarding the plan schedule and process and overview.
That was a lot of information. There is now coffee here, if that helps prime the pump. Do we have questions or comments? I think, you know, as Adam emphasized, if you look at Attachment B, we do plan on the Regional Advisory Working Group being a primary input to the plan update. So most of the months going forward, there's going to be a meeting, and we're going to be bringing these items forward and seeking your input. I mean, one of the things I think that we really appreciated with the plan the last time around is that the mix of people in this room creates some really good dialogue across different sectors, and that was very helpful then, and we think it will be again.
Well, I'll be brave. This is Michelle Rodriguez with the City of San Pablo, and thank you for putting the packet together. I appreciate it and giving the overview. Just referring to attachment A under public outreach, I'd like us just to think a little bit about the social equity aspect of the outreach here in terms of providing multilingual language and just relationships with nonprofits that can provide daycare and food to people who may need it. Then under the specific tasks for B, for call for projects, I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how these might relate to kind of the goals of the land use, housing, and transportation and what we're trying to do here. And there was one other piece under figure three for the regional forecasting model, just where does the greenhouse gases come into play in terms of the selection of the alternatives? Those were the three comments maybe that I had. Thank you.
I can jump in on that. So on the first, I know Ellen Griffin from our legislative and public affairs staff is over there taking notes. In the past, we have had the plan and services available in multiple languages, and I'm sure we will again. And we also had community-based organization engagement that was a pretty key part of the public participation effort for the plan, and we've received a lot of positive feedback about that, so I expect we will again. In terms of the call for projects, as Adam emphasized, we're really trying to have something that doesn't just create a big work effort with no other real purpose. The congestion management agencies, the transit agencies, and other entities that submitted projects for the first plan put a lot of work into that. We had a very detailed project performance assessment, and we want to build upon that. We don't want to just repeat things unnecessarily. So we're at this point still trying to get a handle on exactly what that looks like. But as Adam said, we do have a core capacity transit study underway. A number of the counties have or will have sales tax measures. Some of the regional transit providers may as well, and those things will factor into what that call for projects looks like. One of the hallmarks of the first plan was that the project performance assessment tracked very, very closely to the growth pattern in the plan. It was probably one of the most significant changes that was incorporated post SB 375. So a lot of the most highly ranked projects in the plan tracked very closely to where a lot of the growth in the plan was directed, and we expect that that will continue. And then lastly, on the greenhouse gas target requirement, that is a key part of the different scenarios that we'll be bringing to you, and we'll be looking at how the different land use patterns combined with transportation projects meet or don't meet the greenhouse gas target that the state has set for the region. So that's a pretty critical piece. Other hearing none? Oh, I see a hand. Yes. Could you come to the microphone, please?
Matt Williams, Sierra Club. Following up on the greenhouse gas question, in 2012, the Alameda CMA adopted its long-range plan, and it increases VMT per capita significantly. And then I've been following Santa Clara County's long-range plan, which was adopted on the consent calendar in October. And I couldn't find any figures in the plan that either talk about VMT per capita change over the life of the plan or greenhouse gas change over the life of the plan. And I think because they've been working on it for 3 years, they should have followed MTC's 2000-year guidance, which requires an EIR. And then I followed Contra Costa's draft long-range plan, which is up for adoption this spring. And it results in increased VMT per capita also. I couldn't find any figures in the plan that discuss GHG emissions, and the plan is not financially constrained. So we have two of the three biggest counties have transportation plans that increase VMT per capita, and the biggest county, there doesn't seem to be any information about what the plan will do. If the big counties are doing this, doesn't that make it that much harder for the small counties to average everything out? And then lastly, are the bigger counties helping the Bay Area get on board with Governor Brown's goals in his 2012 executive order? Thank you.
I see a hand from Alameda County.
I just wanted to clarify on the statement that our previous countywide transportation plan increased the VMT. During our last Measure BB campaign, we did clarify that the increased VMT that is shown in the report is related to the existing conditions, 46%. And with the adoption, with the implementation of the new plan, the VMT is going to, the increase will reduce to 26%, while the population is increasing during the plan period by about 30%. So while the population is increasing by 30%, the VMT increase is only 26%, which shows a clear decline in VMT per capita. So that's clearly shown in our hands, fact sheets that we distributed during the campaign. I'll be happy to share that with the with anyone if they're interested.
Thank you. And I guess I'd just add, relative to the other comments and questions, I mean, I think as you're aware, MTC did adopt updated CTP countywide transportation plan guidelines in the fall. They are guidelines, meaning that they are not mandatory on the part of the CMAs, but there was a real effort to create a nexus between the county level plans and the regional plan, and I think we landed in a pretty good place. They are effective for plans going forward. That was one of the things that the commission said very much. They wanted them to be forward looking, not going back and having the counties redo what they had already done. All right. It looks like we're ready to move on to – oh, sorry. Yes.
Good morning. I'm Vita Flores from Marin County, representing the minority communities. And in the advisory council meeting, we discussed sort of bringing more inclusion into the open participation, public participation portion of the Plan Bay Area. And one of the things in Marin that we found that your public participation arenas were along bus lines that had shut down after 6 p.m. And I'm wondering if there is a possibility to have an inclusion of WebEx or some sort of online participation, so streaming the meetings live and then having a call-in or type-in participation for questions so that people can remain in the comfort of their own homes and still participate.
Thanks. Thank you for your comment. I know that, you know, the as Adam said, the public participation plan is still draft. But one of the things that's pretty key, I think, that we learned from the last time is that in a region of 7.5 million people, public meetings are only going to reach so many. And also in a region that essentially invented social media, there are probably other ways to do outreach beyond what we've done. So I think those are helpful comments. Okay. I think we're ready to move on to agenda item 2. Cynthia.
First, I have to learn how to turn the mic on. I think that's done. And I want to thank all of you for being here. From where we sit doing the regional economic and demographic analysis, I find it's really helpful to have people who are more focused on a particular part of the Bay Area or particular issues in the Bay Area to ask us the hard questions as to whether our analysis efforts really are giving the information that's most useful for planning. And so by having all of you here, we're likely to be asked those questions. And I thank you for taking the time to be here. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about our goals in doing the regional forecast and primarily the regional forecast for the region as a whole. We'll get to the distribution aspects of it later on. I'm going to put that in historical context and tell you what we've done in the past and how what we're doing this time is in some ways similar and in some ways different from that. And I will then describe some of the model elements that we're using and talk about our schedule going forward. So you can really think of the regional forecast as being split into two big pieces and then into many smaller ones, but the big pieces are the forecast for the region as a whole and then the forecast or the part of the forecast or the projections that distribute our ideas of what's going to happen long term for the region geographically throughout the region. And our goals are slightly different for those two different pieces of the forecast. For the regional forecast as a whole, We've really been tasked with coming up with a realistic forecast that's based on economic expectations, demographic expectations linked to what's happening in the nation as a whole, in California, and even worldwide. So at the regional level, we'll be forecasting population, employment, labor force, and income based on what it's realistic to expect given the broader economy. When we get to the geographic level of that distribution, we are interested in having something that's realistic in terms of market forces, but that also reflects all of the policy decisions that local governments have made. So in that analysis, we need to use a different set of tools, and we're also interested in how we can make the region-wide plan geographically distributed in a way that meets the state's greenhouse gas requirements and any other requirements that have been put on us by the state of California. So ABAG has been doing some kind of regional modeling for a long time. And in fact, I was here briefly in the 1980s when I'd say a cutting edge approach to doing this was being developed here. And many of the pieces of what was developed then are not that different from what we'll be using now in terms of concept. There was an overall regional economic and demographic model that forecast employment, that forecast population, and then there were separate distributional pieces that spread that population and the jobs and housing throughout the region. Unfortunately, we can't just pick up what they had and use it because the earlier models were really developed on a very different economy. And over time, different people who have worked here have adjusted the approaches that we've used. In projections 2013, a somewhat simpler approach was used than had it been used in the past in that, and much of it was done by consultants. They, as you'll see, as I'm going to look at what the past forecasts were and what they produced, I think they produced a very realistic forecast using those methods, but it was harder to test alternatives because it was done in so many pieces. So we're hoping to develop a set of systems that integrate a little bit more closely together that we can use so that we can really think about alternatives at the very beginning of our work and then be able to understand them going forward. So I thought it would be interesting to look at how well projections work, because in some ways I think of doing a 30-year projection as social science fiction. But so has ABAG been doing a good job at that? So here are actual population levels for the region from 1990 through 2010. And I'm going to start with 1987 projection, which you can see was pretty close but a little bit low. The other thing to notice about 1987 was, they had a really different, they were doing an ambitious effort with a much cruder set of tools and equipment, and they only did 15 years. They weren't as ambitious as we were to move out to 30. So by 1992, they were up to 20 years in terms of the length of time they were projecting for, but they were, again, pretty close, but now starting to be a little bit high for population levels. The 1996 looked pretty similar to the 1992, and so forth. 2002 gets closer to the line, but that's because we're talking about projections that happened after 2000, so you would hope that 1990 to 2000 would be right. And they're a little high for 2010. And then 2007, 2013. One thing to notice that they're all pretty close. Some are a little high, some are a little low. But you could almost just draw a straight line along the actual trends that had happened from 90 to 95 and come up with a similar set of projections. So why don't we just take a ruler and do that rather than spend all this money on modeling? And I'll talk a little bit more about why, even if the ruler would give us the right answer for the total, it's not a very useful answer if we're interested in thinking about housing supply and where people will live and what kind of housing they need. So now let's look at employment projections. And these are employment levels. These are the actual employment levels that we get data on in a timely fashion, and they're from EDD using Bureau of Labor Statistics data. So you can see right away that it's going to be a bit harder to draw a straight line through that and project out because employment is quite a bit more volatile than population. And actually, the employment numbers that BLS track are a little less than the numbers that ABAG uses in its forecast because they don't include the self-employed. So it's about 6 to 8% less. So I've added a line, dotted line, 6% higher than that. So we have a better comparison with what the forecasts actually were. And here's the 1987 forecast. And I would say it did pretty well. It was a little bit high in 2005, but that was kind of at the end of the dot-com bust. But here we start going out with a forecast that's pretty similar, adjusting for reality. This is the 1992, and you can see it's getting quite high by 2010. The 1996 actually was a little bit closer. That one was responding to the fact that we'd had 3 years of very slow growth in the early 1990s. But then we started to recover from that growth, and this 2002 one was actually done 2001 at the very end of the dot-com boom, and people were very optimistic about what would happen. Then they made some adjustments down in 2007, and the 2013 projections, which I have to say when I first looked at them alone I thought were kind of high, are clearly much more modest and moderated than most of the earlier projections. So the story here is that, yeah, you could, if you kind of averaged out what was going on with that dotted line from 1990 to 2010, you would get something that looks a lot like our projections 2013. But if you decided you were going to do that projections at a time when you were closer to the earlier peak, you would get something much higher. So employment is really challenging to project, and employment does have implications for population projections, which we'll see more of in a minute. I have to say, just to lighten things up, this reminds me of a story about three economists who went hunting together, and one of them took a shot at a deer and it was too far to the left. One of them took a shot at the deer and it was too far to the right. And the third one said, "We're done, we hit it." So, but for us, you know, we will play with different alternatives before we say we've hit it. And unlike the deer, there won't be any proof as to whether we really did or not for some time. So this is to go back to the style that in which I showed the earlier projections. We're now going to have a set of models that allow us to project everything from regional output and gross regional product to employment and population and overall income levels. And then we will be building internally models to project households, income by households, to look at occupations. And then we will cooperate with MTC in the working out the distribution of population, households, and jobs throughout the region. So this chart really then summarizes where the regional forecasting process is happening within our two agencies. ABAG is entirely responsible for coming up with numbers regarding what's going to happen in the future for the region as a whole and for large subregions within our area. MTC and ABAG are working together using UrbanSim. MTC is going to be primarily in charge of the modeling for UrbanSim. And if you have any questions on that today, Michael Riley is here today and is really the person who's creating that and adapting that to our needs at MTC. But ABAG will be heavily involved in that, and all of you who are from local agencies, we hope, will be heavily involved in that as well, because there will be a lot of there will be a real iterative approach in which Urban Sim makes its forecasts, everybody comments on them, perhaps some adjustments are made to what's going into Urban Sim or how it's then doing the distribution, and we come up with another set of forecasts. Anyway, that will produce a geographic distribution, and then MTC alone will be doing the travel model and will be doing the greenhouse gas estimates and whatever other environmental estimates are required. So back to the first part of that model, how are we doing the regional forecasting piece? So we'll do it in three big segments that we call Bay Pop, Bay Econ, and Bay Home. The population forecast will produce information by age, the household by age, race, ethnicity. The economic forecast will produce employment, income, output, and that in turn will then feed into understanding what happens with the population through migration adjustments. And then both the population model and the economic model will feed into our analysis of what will happen with households and with housing units. So I want, if there's time, looks like there is, I want to say a little bit about each of these pieces of the modeling process. Our population model, we decided to work with some consultants on that, although now we're taking their information and integrating it with our economic model. So the consultants were John Pitkin and Dal Myers, and they're really the leading authorities on how immigrant communities affect population growth. And so the way that they analyze a cohort survival model is different from the traditional, and it's different from what's in REMI, which is our economic model. So they have done an analysis for us that produces a forecast of both natural increase in the population, and then they've looked at migration just in terms of, again, how these characteristics of different population groups affect their likelihood to move. So they've added their migration piece to the puzzle. They don't do very much about the economic side of it, and one of our tasks is to then integrate what we learn about population from them into the economic side and integrate the economics into population. But I want, you know, thinking back to that line that just showed kind of steady population growth, even if that continues, and were we dependent only on natural increase, it probably wouldn't continue at that same pace. The increment of change in any one year is actually looks quite a bit more variable than the overall population level does. And the increment of change is important, is perhaps more important to us than the overall population level, because that's really what determines how many new homes you need. So it's variable in a number of ways. First, you can see the natural increase, which is the blue segment of those bars, is fairly regular, at least, in how it changes. But even that is not the same over time. It grew from the 70s through the 90s, and then it started shrinking a little bit again in terms of the total number of new people added because of births minus deaths. But the migration is very variable. And in fact, we haven't had a positive five-year period of what's called domestic migration, which is net the difference between people moving in and those moving out, since the 1970s. We've certainly had positive years when we had more people moving in than moving out, probably, or have had something like that the last couple of years. But if you look at it over a five-year period, it's just a question of how big it is. But then that's been counterbalanced with a lot of international immigration, which also is not completely stable, but has been positive for each of these five-year periods. So that's at the overall level. Then if you look at it among different groups, there are big differences in age and there are big differences in ethnic categories, somewhat determined by age and by whether or not it's an immigrant population or not, that affect how quickly that population grows, both in terms of natural increase and in terms of migration. And those in turn can have different implications for the labor force, for housing demand, and so forth. So all of that information is we're considering as we do the overall regional population projection, as we do the employment projection. We've invested in the REMI model, which is probably the most now the most frequently used model for analysis at the regional level. For any agency that doesn't build its own. There are a number of metropolitan areas that use it either for impact analysis or for forecasting, and it's not just COGS, it's other agencies like air quality districts use it as well. And the state of California uses it for impact analysis also. So we have, this gives us the ability to coordinate with what they're doing and understand how what's happening in the region is related to what's happening in the state as well. Our version of REMI also uses also splits up into four subregions, which allows us to give account to Urban SIM to start with in distributing things throughout the region as a whole. Nevertheless, it's a model that comes down from a national model, and there are some assumptions in what we've been given out of the box that are kind of generic to the U.S. rather than really reflective of the Bay Area. So we are comparing the results to alternative methodologies, and REMI is very friendly to making customized adjustments to the model, and that's one of the things we've been working on for the last few months with it. As you can see, it's a model with many moving parts, but one can just leave most of those parts alone if they seem reasonable and focus on the ones that are really key to the problems that we're working with. So we're focusing on the population component, the employment component, income, and housing prices. So REMI gives us all of those pieces. It also gives a population and migration count. We're going back with what we've gotten out of Pitkin and Myers and saying, well, which of these is right? They're actually quite different from each other coming out of the box. And migration is the key component that makes that difference. And we are also looking at employment levels that are being generated by REMI out of the box versus what seems more realistic. And eventually we'll reconcile the two. So this next chart illustrates that process of doing the reconciliation where first we do some adjustments to REMI, we update some of the factors, we adjust relative costs, which, as I said, are quite generic in REMI and don't really reflect what's happening in the region. Then we try and look at how what we come up with reconciles with what the state is finding in terms of overall statewide growth. We add in the demographic information that comes from our Bay POP model and adjust the REMI to a second base. So, you know, we have the standard base, then we have a base that we've adjusted just within REMI, then we add the population information, we come up with a revised population forecast, and that plus the income information and the employment information that comes out of REMI then all have to go into the housing module to project what's going to happen with households and housing units. So that's the next piece of our process where we have to translate all of this output from these models on population, jobs, and income to group quarters populations into households by income category. Housing construction is actually going to come through an iterative process that includes both the information we will get on the number of households. It will include information that comes from REMI on the amount of employment that or the amount of investment that goes into real estate. And then it also includes information that we will get back from UrbanSim on that's done a market analysis on real estate development. Because as you'll see, household size is not a steady state. So the household formation process, we're really modeling after what we've learned from our consultants on population, because there are also many differences related to age, ethnicity, nativity, whether it's an immigrant family or not, on how households, how people combine into households. So that will be taken into account in our household component. But as I said, I like to say household size is not exogenous, which means we can't just say, okay, we've got this population. This is then the average household size and the number of housing units we need. Even after going through that process in this that I've diagrammed here, households size is also very sensitive to what's happening in the economy and what's happening with housing availability and housing prices. So you can see even from 2005 to 2013, just an eight-year period, those don't look like very big variations in household size, but a tenth of a person variation in household size is about a 4% variation in demand for housing units. So it can be quite significant. And then, of course, there are big differences even within the region among counties, much bigger differences than these annual differences. So all that, we find all that a lot of fun to think about. we will come up with there's clearly a range of actual numbers that could be realistic going forward. And we will provide, where our challenge is to provide a single set of numbers to UrbanSim to start working with. And that's what we will do. And when we start working, we welcome your comments on all of our region-wide forecasts, but when we start working on UrbanSim, we really are going to be soliciting your participation and your review, because UrbanSim is a pretty powerful model that can be built based on a relatively small amount of data, but the accuracy of that model will be much better if we have really good data from the local areas. A lot of effort's gone into creating a good database, but that effort began in 2012, and updates are needed all the time, and we really are going to be relying on local governments to provide that kind of updated information and to provide a reality check when we come out with something that says, this PDA will get thousands of new housing units, or this PDA won't get anything. We rely on you to come back and say, wait a minute, have you really looked at what's happening here? That doesn't meet our plans, and why not? So this will be a period when there will be a lot of back and forth before we come up with a final distribution of housing, jobs, population. That then will go to MTC for their travel modeling. So that's what we're planning to do. What have we done to date? We've done initial runs for the population and employment segments of the models. We have established a technical advisory committee. We met with that committee in September and again in November, and expect to meet with them again either at the end of this month or the beginning of next month. That committee that's a technical committee, so it's entirely people who have done, used, understand this kind of model, because we want to be sure that we're using methodology that's broadly accepted. We count on groups like this to then provide us the other kind of feedback, which we also need, which is just a reality check. We have begun some collaboration with other COGs, and particularly with the San Joaquin COG, to talk about these issues about what happens at the border. And we also need to work with CARB on the commute. Our household model design is underway, but we haven't begun doing any estimates. That will happen in the next few months and to come. With that and after that will be the income estimates. The geographic distribution to jurisdictions will probably begin in the spring, and then we'll be doing a lot of recalibrations and adjustments and finally have working regional totals towards the end of this year. I really welcome conversations, you know, not only with our technical group, but with people who are going to ultimately use these forecasts so that I can be better prepared to develop forecasts that are useful to you. So we have some systems set up, but, you know, the door is also open for informal questions and discussions. Thank you for your time. Other questions? Yeah.
Thank you for the presentation. That was quite informative. I've got a couple questions, I think three. The first one, you mentioned that ABAG is responsible for the greenhouse gas estimates. Okay, is MTC responsible?
MTC is responsible for the greenhouse gas estimates.
Great, thank you. And then the second one was, I was curious as to what methodology changes are being implemented since the last round of Plan Bay Area. I wasn't real clear if the REMI model was used in the previous process or not.
So the last round of Plan Bay Area, the employment projections were done by the Center for the Continuing Study of the California Economy, Steve Levy, using a shift share analysis. So that did not use REMI. The population projections were really came out of that, in that the assumption was that if you have this level of employment, then you need this level of labor force. There was some cohort survival analysis to determine how much of that labor force might be homegrown, and then the rest was assumed to be migration. But the analysis really didn't separate out those two components of population growth. And then the distribution of those forecasts happened basically with a relative shares approach. So there really wasn't a distributional model such as UrbanSim that did that. UrbanSim was used later on to do the environmental impact analysis.
Great, thank you. Sounds like I missed a lot of fun last time that
you did.
Which I was here for. And then my last question was regarding the UrbanSim model. You said it was an iterative process with local policies really feeding into that. And I was curious if you could explain how the public process correlates with that land use and iterative cycle.
So I'll say a little bit about that, but I'm not the person in charge of the public process, but I'll talk a little bit about how ABAG is doing this. So ABAG has a neighborhood planning group, and we have planners within that group who are assigned to work with different parts of the region and with jurisdictions within those areas. And so those planners are already beginning to talk to those jurisdictions about what would be the best way to interact. There's some experimentation being done with something called Urban Canvas, which is being developed by the developers of UrbanSim, and that allows communities to go in and look at what's happening in their area based on the forecast and then add information or correct things that don't look right. So that would be one way of doing it. It's not something that we expect every jurisdiction to do, but there will be communication with jurisdictions as we need information and as initial projections come out. So the communication will be primarily through the planning department, unless there are other groups that indicate that they also want to be involved. Yeah.
Just add to that. So the intent is to set up a base camp, as we did before, countywide, and then provide information that's coming out of UrbanSim, get local input, make adjustments, inform everybody what those adjustments are, and then create three scenarios that would sort of bookend different assumptions, and one in the middle. Hopefully that's the one that is preferred. And then the planners would bring those three scenarios to their city councils. Then the council would provide comments to those scenarios, which would yield the final set of comments that would produce the preferred alternative for the environmental review that would get adopted as a preferred alternative by the agencies. So the public process for the scenarios in your jurisdiction will come through the identification of growth in your three scenarios.
Ezra, just you might want to clarify the scenarios that you're describing happens later in the process after the forecast. It's not part of the forecasting process in case there's a conflation there.
Right. It's the forecast is independent. You can see that in your plan, in your milestone chart, when the forecast is done and when the three scenarios are developed for comments from city councils. Now, we will try to assist local jurisdictions with a PowerPoint and maybe a self-executing PowerPoint with a voiceover or something that would be of aid to the local planner in terms of getting that presentation ready for city council. But that will be done by the local planning department, not by ABAG. We will assist any jurisdictions that are having difficulty with it and, of course, answer questions. Yes?
Are you expecting to do a financial...
Can you come to the microphone, please?
Thank you.
Are you expecting to do an unconstrained scenario like last time, financially unconstrained?
Yeah, are you referring to land use planning or transportation planning?
Either.
Okay, let's take the land use. Last time we did something to kick off the process that I think was very counterproductive, and it was called the initial vision scenario, where we just sort of laid out, you know, a tremendous amount of housing and assume that we weren't going to have in commute and, you know, things like that that were unrealistic. That caused a lot of blowback and I think set us off on a very poor footing. So we are not going to do that again.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that.
Three realistic assumptions for the scenarios.
Great. Thanks.
And then on transportation, I think they are all going to be constrained, correct?
Correct. Questions? Yes.
Amber Crapp with San Francisco. Just wondering two questions. First of all, how do the land use scenarios relate to the transportation scenarios? It seems like there's work going on at the same time, according to the calendar. And then second question, I'm wondering how housing affordability is taken into account in the model.
I can take the first one in terms of the scenarios. They'll be developed together, which was the approach we took last time. And the projects and the mix of projects will be correlated with the growth patterns in the different scenarios. That'll be part of the iterative process. And we'll be bringing that to you to these meetings, so I'm sure there'll be a lot of discussion about that component. And Cynthia, if you want to take the other piece.
Well, the economic model that we have does look at relative housing prices compared to the nation. It doesn't provide much information beyond a large sub-regional level on relative housing prices within the region. So that's a really good question that I'm going to have to think about more as we do the housing module.
Yeah, I think, as we all know, there's a huge gap between income levels and what housing prices are in the preferred locations in particular. So the last time we assumed a substantial amount of affordable housing dollars coming from a new state program, which was being discussed at the legislature. All those discussions now, though, appear to be dead or stymied, and it's going to be more difficult to make an assumption that there's going to be affordable housing money to fill the gap. So it becomes a much more relevant question. As far as the transportation network goes, and trying to achieve the GHG emissions with the land use pattern. I think Matt raised this point earlier. We have a 2005 baseline that we're going to continue to use to establish the VMT. But since then, we've had a substantial increase in vehicle miles per gallon on the vehicle side, which we're not allowed to take into account, and the reduction of gas prices. I don't know how sustainable that is, but those are two factors that work against trying to control VMT. So in order to achieve greenhouse gas savings and reduce VMT, there's going to have to be significant policy considerations to try to match that up. That might be part of the equations, too, as we go through these different scenarios. But a lot of that, I think, are unanswered questions that are, you know, part of the exercise here. You know, what are the realistic options, and what's politically feasible, and how do they perform when we put them up against the models? When we try to look at greenhouse gas emissions from this process, we also have to compare them to what's going to be expected under AB 32, which is a much, 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 much larger greenhouse gas emissions reduction, but takes into account all aspects of society and the economy, not just this sliver that we're working on here with land use and transportation.
So I wanted to add one thing back to the affordable housing specifically, which is that that is taken into account in urban SIM, but the question is, as Ezra says, how will we determine within urban SIM how much affordable housing can be provided?
Are we live? Yeah, thanks. Ezra, this is Matt Regan from the Bay Area Council. Follow on to the comments that you made about VMT. All the city planners are probably familiar with the great emissions crisis of the 1890s that cities across the world suffered. And there were meetings like this in cities around primarily Europe. London had a big meeting, and all the city planners got together to discuss emissions from transportation. And they devised a 50-year planning strategy on how to reduce horse manure. The predictions were that London streets would be under 9 feet of horse manure by 1925. Of course, we know that didn't happen. Technology sort of got in the way. So that's a long way of saying I hope that the planning process includes some flexibility. If VMT is a proxy for CO2, which we assume it is, we're trying to reduce VMT to reduce CO2. Let's not forget that we're at 5% right now market share of electric cars and plug-in hybrids. That's the fastest growing sector of the auto purchasing market. If we're at 50% by the time this plan is at its maturity, VMT is going to slowly become an irrelevant statistic if we have zero emission vehicles. So what we should be trying to do really is to reduce congestion. A fleet of cars left the Bay Area this week to go to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, driverless. These cars drive bumper to bumper at high speeds. So if we can reduce congestion and reduce emissions from those vehicles, we're making VMT a redundant statistic. So let's, in our long-range planning, let's not lock ourselves into processes and data points that may become irrelevant as technology passes us by.
Just a couple of follow-up points. One is, with the update of the plan, one of the areas that we do tend to add emphasis on is new technologies, which is something we had about three paragraphs on in the last plan or the first plan Bay Area. And we kind of think as the regional planning agencies of the Silicon Valley region, we should probably do better than that. So that will be something that we focus on in the update. I do think it's important to remember, though, on two pieces. One is that there are lots of good reasons for our communities in the region to plan together in terms of how we grow. And I think oftentimes when we get into the greenhouse gas discussion, we kind of lose sight of a lot of those benefits, and hopefully we won't as we move forward. But also specifically related to GHG, we're subject to the statute of Senate Bill 375. It's very clear about what can be counted and what cannot. And transportation and land use and the nexus is what it's about. As Ezra said, it's not a big percentage of the overall greenhouse gas strategy for California, but it is the law that this plan has to be adopted under. and it really narrows what can be counted and what cannot toward attaining that target.
Yes, and I actually find your comments germane and a source of frustration for our agencies that we are locked into a rigid parameter that the law has set up. When actually the land use program that we're talking about has many, many co-benefits in terms of resource management, less water usage, for example, far less energy, lots of efficiencies, higher quality of life, amenities, walking, biking, possibly improvement of social services as well, and in areas with potential mixed income housing. So I think we see a tremendous economic benefit for the type of land use pattern that we're talking about, the co-benefits. Unfortunately, we can't count them towards the state target. And so the state target is too rigid to really reflect the value of the work that we're doing. And that becomes more of a narrative in terms of explaining the reason why we're doing this planning. When we talk to citizens and when we talk in our meetings or we talk to locally elected officials, we need to focus on all the benefits of this type of land use planning and not just the metric that was chosen by the state. We are going to have to compare what we're doing to AB 32. I mean, the courts really want to see that. That was in the appellate decision of Sandag, a very important decision. Didn't look particularly legal, but that's what they said. And we're going to have to be more extensive in terms of our discussion about greenhouse gas emissions in the region beyond what this program does.
It seems I remember last year that the Air Quality Board, the Regional Air Quality Board, came out with standards that really wouldn't allow the densities that we're talking about in our housing, and it was put on hold when it went to court. Are they giving input into the new plan, and I don't see them at the table, and I don't see them as part of this, but they can create a stopping action by coming up with standards that don't allow us to do the housing we want to do or allow us to do the smart growth, and in the long run gives us all better air quality.
We've been having a lot of meetings with the Air District. There is a contradiction because they are very much in favor of infill development, and at the same time they are very concerned about exposure to toxic air contaminants. A few points that are really salient. One is the pollution that's expected to be emitted by vehicles is going to be reduced by 75%. And the models that demonstrated the unhealthy benefits were using a different background scenario of contaminants that were much higher. Secondly, socioeconomic factors correlate strongly with the health outcomes that they were counting in terms of people living close to the freeway, which tended to be populated by relatively poor people who have, you know, many other challenges facing their health conditions. So the Air District has tried to moderate their position, and they're now removing these CEQA guidelines and referring to a report called Planning Healthy Places. And in that report, I think it's not finished yet, but I'm hoping that it will not create a set of conditions that make it difficult to plan. I mean, there are mitigation strategies that can be used, like trees, that are very effective in terms of capturing particles, and I think if we can, boil this down to a set of mitigations that are concrete, that don't require a huge analysis, that don't chill interest by developers in these areas, which we need to be developed in order to meet the plan. And have this infill development and greater transit use, et cetera, that the health benefits are best for everybody. So the Air District is very supportive of that idea. But they're trying to balance two things, and they haven't quite yet succeeded enough to publish. But it's a good comment, and it's something that we all need to track very carefully.
They'll be bringing the Planning Healthy Places guidelines to a future meeting of the ROG, probably within the next few months. Not seeing any other hands, we'll move on to agenda item 3, which is the Vital Signs Performance Initiative. This is an initiative that the regional agencies have been working on. It's a new web portal. It's both a look back and a tracking mechanism for a whole range of issues that's going to be up and running soon. And Dave Vaughton is here to talk to us about it.
Good morning. Dave Vaughton with MTC Planning. I'm joined by Kristen Carnarius, who's also part of the Vital Signs project team. We're very happy today to share with you the results of Phase 1A of Vital Signs, which dealt with transportation, and to tell you a little bit about what's going to be coming online in the next few weeks. So first of all, what is Vital Signs? Vital Signs is a performance monitoring initiative. It is a brand new effort. It's designed to track progress towards a lot of our key regional goals. It is an MTC-led project, but we're working very closely with our regional partners, particularly on land use and economy, with the ABAG team, as well as the Air District and the BCDC on the environmental measures. So the goal here is really to create a portal for the public, for planners, to track, see where the region has been and where we are, to help us understand what's happening. And to answer some very simple but core questions. So we're really starting at the beginning here. How are people getting around the region? Where are they choosing to live and work? How's our economy doing? And what are the environmental conditions that Bay Area residents experience? So what I'm going to share today is the project framework, and then we'll discuss some of the results from the transportation phase. The Vital Signs Project really has four components for each of those four phases. So we look at the scoping of the measures themselves. We've been collecting data from publicly available sources and trying to clean them and translate them so they're ready for anyone in the general public to examine. We're also constructing a narrative and building interactives. So one of the unique things about the project is we're not doing a traditional paper report. This will be an interactive website with a series of interactive elements, so you'll be able to look at maps, charts, you can read the narrative, really explore the data. And we've spent a lot of time and effort building interactives that are simple enough for the public to use, but also powerful enough for planners to use in their day-to-day work. Another interesting thing about the project is we went beyond what MTC had done in the past with performance monitoring, which is just focusing on regional trends. So we've done three different analyses for each of the topic areas examined. So we've conducted a historical analysis to look at, in some cases, back to the 1960s, where the region has been. We've done a regional context analysis, which means we're looking at cities, counties, neighborhoods. So we've collected data all the way down to the neighborhood level when it's available. And then third is we've been looking at the competitiveness of the Bay Area, doing a metro comparison analysis against 9 other major metro areas, which when we include the Bay Area, constitute the top 10 most populated metro areas in the U.S. It's actually quite an interesting list because it gives us the broad range of more traditional transit-oriented metros like New York and Chicago, as well as Sunbelt metros like Dallas, Miami, Houston. So we really get a nice broad spectrum of the United States top metros. The Bay Area is fourth most populous. It's just over 7 million people. This chart here is just to show for one measure how much we've really collected in terms of data. So the website not only features these public-oriented interactives that are designed to tell the story to someone who maybe doesn't have as much expertise, we've also collected and cleaned data sets for all these blue boxes shown on the slide. So we have historical data, we have intra-regional data, and we've looked at this one particular measure, commute mode share, both by the residential and employment locations. So there's a lot of data sets that are going to be available on this site, and we've tried to translate them into interactives. In terms of the project schedule, we kicked it off in the spring with the measure scoping. We did a lot of the analysis for transportation and land use over the summer and fall, and we're preparing to launch Phase 1A, which is the transportation measures, this month. We're also in the middle of conducting analysis for the future phases, economy and environment, at the moment. And we plan on launching those, the land use and economy measures in March, and then the environmental measures in May. We've been doing a lot of outreach as well. In the past few months, we've shown the results from this first phase as well as the project scope to all the groups shown up here on the slides. The ROG today is actually the last of these set of meetings. We're going to our planning committee on Friday, and that will be the first time we do a live demo of the website. We're going to show off some of the features the site has and also give our commissioners a first look at the results before we launch the site later this month. To give you a sense of what measures will be included in these initial launches, so Phase 1A, these icons represent some of the issue areas where we have. So we have data on mode share, commute times, commute flows, interregional travel, congestion, both in terms of time and mileage, freeway travel time reliability, VMT data, transit ridership, transit cost effectiveness, safety data, and state of good repair for roads, bridges, highways, and transit. In the Phase 1B, which is land use, which will be coming out in a couple months, we have data on population, jobs, new construction, and greenfield development. And you'll see in your packet a list of measures for the economy and environment. They just didn't happen to fit up here on the slide. So another 20-plus measures for those issue areas. So with that, I want to turn it over to Kristen. She's going to go through some of our findings from Phase 1A.
So these are just a subset of the types of findings that you'll find on our website. These are mostly focused on, these are only the transportation findings so far. So our first finding is that despite the changes in the Bay Area over the last several decades, the regional commute mode shares and commute times have remained remarkably steady. This is an area chart that shows different decades starting from 1960 to 2012. Of the mode share, the regional mode shares. And so the big red area is the auto mode share, which includes driving and carpooling. So this might not be a surprise, but almost 80% of Bay Area residents will drive in some form to get to work. The orange share is transit, and that's been at steadily at 10% for the last several decades. We have walking at 4%, other at 3%, which includes bicycling. That's motorcycle, bicycling, and then working at home is the blue area at the top. The next chart shows the changes in these shares over different decades, and so you might notice that in the 1960s to through the 80s, the auto mode shares were increasing, which corresponds to more of the suburbanization that was happening in the Bay Area at the time. But in the last this blue bar, which is the last decade, 2000 to 2012, the largest share to have grown is the telecommute share, in addition to walking, biking, and transit. Now, the transit. This is a chart of transit mode share, which shows the variation of mode shares among the counties in the Bay Area. And so, San Francisco has the highest transit mode share, which is not surprising. The majority of the counties are at the 10% regional average, but we have Santa Clara County, which is the biggest county to have a transit mode share of less than 5%. And the North Bay counties are in the same ballpark as Santa Clara County. Then corresponding with the commute shares being the same, the commute times have also stayed relatively the same since 1980, since the earliest point that we've been tracking the data. So the average for all modes has been around 25 to 27 minutes. And the last 4 years, we've been able to break out the commute time by mode, which might explain the low transit mode share in the Bay Area, where you see the transit time is 1.8 times the drive-alone time to get to work. Right. Our next finding, which still relates back to commuting, is that most commuters live and work in the same county, although the two major counties, Santa Clara and San Francisco, import significant numbers of workers. So this chart shows the share of residents that live and work in the same county, and actually all of the counties have this share is greater than half. So the lowest share is 60%, which is in San Mateo County. So the share of people who work in that county also live in the county is 60%. And that makes sense because San Mateo County is between two other major job centers, and so people might be commuting out of San Mateo for Santa Clara or San Francisco County. Similarly, Solano and Contra Costa and Marin are more bedroom-type counties where there's more housing and less fewer job centers. When we see Santa Clara County, and actually Sonoma County, you know, it's a significantly high proportion of people are living and working in the same county. Now this chart actually talks about the net number of commuters. So for, it's the sum of people who are leaving plus the people who are coming into a county in a typical work day. So San Francisco and Santa Clara counties, their number of employees will grow by over 100,000 people in a given day. San Francisco at the highest with 150,000 people. Then back to the bedroom community type hypothesis, Contra Costa and Solano will actually lose the number of employees to the other counties in a typical workday. And related to these commute patterns, here we have the commute pattern between the Bay Area and other counties, are the counties that are surrounding, you know, the Bay Area county. So we have here the number of vehicles that are coming in and out of our gateways, what we're calling them, which hit a peak in around 2006, but has been decreasing since then, although last year there was a slight uptick in the number of people traveling between Bay Area and other counties. And what's interesting about this, too, is that of all the employees in the Bay Area, only 2% are coming from out of the region. And then following on this commute story, we also see that traffic congestion and transit demand are highly concentrated in the central Bay Area, which is not totally surprising since that's where a lot of the jobs are. When we're talking about traffic congestion, it's important to understand how we're measuring it. So this is a line chart that tracks two types of delay. One is the orange line is the delay that you might experience on the freeway where you're traveling less than the speed limit. And that line has been pretty affected by the last recession. But the bottom line is a subset of that delay where you're traveling in congestion, which is traveling less than 35 miles per hour. And that's an important threshold beyond which the freeway is no longer serving as many people as it could possibly serve. So the amount of people that can go on that can travel on the roads is less than the theoretical maximum. And that has remained remarkably stable also since the 90s at about 2 minutes per person per day, per commuter per day, and has increased in the last year to 2.6 minutes per commuter per day. And so then we have a chart where you can see where the congestion is happening within the region. So these are freeways, congestion on freeways again, and if you look at the Alameda share plus the Contra Costa share, the central part, which is the central part of the Bay Area, those freeways have over half of the congestion in the region. If you add in Santa Clara, then you have almost 75% of the congestion is happening in these three counties. So counties in the northern part of the region are not experiencing as much congestion as in the central part. And then the corollary to traffic congestion is where the transit boarding is happening. This chart shows the share of regional boardings by operator. And so we have Muni carrying 45% of the region's transit boardings. If we add BART in, then we have 75% of the region's boardings happening with these two operators, which is, again, heavily concentrated in the central part of the Bay Area. Now I'm going to turn it over to Dave to finish up the findings.
So our fourth finding was related to the connection between congestion and travel time reliability on our freeway system. So although we do have higher levels of traffic congestion than some other major metro areas, we actually have the most reliable freeway travel time. So here's a map showing those top 10 metro areas. As you can see, Los Angeles comes in number one. Their congestion is about twice as bad as the Bay Area. And our congestion levels are pretty similar to those in Houston. The congestion levels in places like Philadelphia and Miami were about, those were the best metro areas for the least traffic. They had about half the traffic congestion delays of our region. Now, when we look at the buffer time index, which is a measure of reliability, effectively, how much time do you have to buffer, add before your trip to make sure you get there on time, the Bay Area actually is the best. Our reliability is three times higher than Washington, D.C., which has the most unreliable travel times. So we're deeming this a concept of reliable congestion. That is, it will be there, but at least your travel time to get to where you want to go is relatively consistent. Our fifth finding is related to the asset conditions that we've seen. So for bridges and highways, we've seen some very measurable improvements, but we haven't seen that on the local roads front. So here's the PCI, the Pavement Condition Index for the region. As you can see here, it's remained stable at 66 for a number of years. When we look at some other measures for the highway system and the bridges, we've seen improvements. So here's the regional share of distressed lane miles. So effectively, how bumpy are our freeways? We're actually at the best conditions on record since the year 2000, and our freeways are about a third smoother than they were at that time. Now, with the bridges, we've also seen some pretty measurable improvements, although the region still has the bridges in the worst condition of any major metro area in the U.S. We've made some major gains, obviously, with the toll bridge retrofits, and you can see that here as the improvements. We've approximately halved our number of structurally deficient bridges over this time period of the last decade. Finally, let's talk a little bit about transit. So we took a hard look at what's going on with transit ridership in the region, and although the total ridership has increased over the last two decades, the per capita use of transit has actually decreased over this time period. Here's a graph showing the total ridership of transit since 1991, which was when the federal government began collecting this annual data. And what you can see for our region is it's gone up by about 3% from 1991 levels. And there's the spikes really occur during the boom periods, and then there's typically a drop in ridership following a recession. Now, when we look at per capita ridership, this is the number of times a Bay Area resident boards transit each year. There's been a 14% decline over this time period. This trend reflects the fact that the region, there's been growth in suburban areas as well as in the South Bay, where transit is used a little bit less than it is in the core part of the region. And it also reflects what's happening in San Francisco. So when we look at the ridership based off of the number of folks who live in each of the different transit agency service areas, you can see here how obviously San Franciscans take transit a lot more than residents of other parts of the region. As this graph shows, about almost 300 boardings per year for the average San Francisco resident. But this ridership level has also declined over this time period. So Muni's decline has also, given that they're almost half of all regional transit trips, has also pulled the Bay Area average for transit use down over this time period. Now, the story that we always hear about in the papers is this story, which is rail ridership has gone up significantly over this time period. Caltrain, after the implementation of the Baby Bullet service, as well as BART, have seen per capita growth since then, but all of the other major operators have seen decline. And although Muni ridership has declined somewhat, the declines have been even greater for the suburban bus operators. As this chart shows, declines between 20 and 40% since 1991 on operators like AC Transit, VTA, Golden Gate, and Samtrans. And when we compare ourselves to other metro areas, our performance is only better than Dallas, Houston, and Atlanta. Those metros have seen very stark declines in transit usage, especially given their more sprawling growth patterns. But we are not performing as well as what we might consider some of our peer metro areas, like New York, which has seen a significant growth in transit use, Los Angeles, which has built out a pretty robust transit system since the early 90s, and we're lagging other places like D.C. and Chicago, which have experienced slight declines, but not as significant as the Bay Area. So I want to conclude with just a couple points. First of all, these six stories are just among dozens that we're showcasing on the website. We wanted to try to pull together some of the key themes. And I want to point out that the website will be launching later this month, hopefully with our commission meeting on the 28th of January, and we'll be doing a demo of the site at the planning committee. And we just want you all to go check it out, and we really are looking forward to your feedback. Although we want to get the public engaged and tell this story to the public, this is also a site that can be used by planners. There's a large amount of data there. We've built in some great features that allow you to pull the data directly into PowerPoint slides. And we want it to be useful for you. So please, let us know your feedback. So with that, we're happy to take any questions on the project or the findings of this first phase.
Thank you for the presentation, and I'm looking forward to the soft launch. I'm wondering if there will be accurate drive time or interactive drive time, such as a Waze app. I don't know if you're familiar with the Waze app.
So we're not building a site that's showing real-time information. It's more we're trying to show annual historical information so we can understand trends. We do have a great interactive specifically on congestion that allows you to see over the course of the day where the congestion is in the region. It's, you can go and zoom into your neighborhood and see what's going on there. Hopefully that gets at the issue. We want to be able to see what's going on our freeway system.
Dave, can you tell, or is this another phase with changes in transit ridership? Is that a result of changes in where people live, or is it just within a given area people are riding somewhat less?
So when we launched land use, we've done a lot of the land use analysis already. When we launched the land use phase, we'll be talking a lot about those trends and where people are living and working and how that might be impacting the transit ridership trends. But as I said, the results that we see on the regional level are being affected by multiple effects across the region. In San Francisco, growth in the South Bay, growth in suburban locations, service cuts on bus operators, all those sorts of factors.
Hi, this is Brent Cooper. I'm from American Canyon in Napa County, and really appreciate your discussion and look forward to looking at the website and seeing what information you have on there. You talked about congestion, which I know is a very big issue. Probably isn't anyone in the room that doesn't think congestion's a major issue in their area. But I noticed that it's in Napa County, and in particular in my city, congestion on Highway 29 is the number one issue. If you ask anybody, it comes up the very first thing that concerns them. Yet I don't see it mentioned at all in here. And I think maybe it's because our area as a population is very small within the Bay Area. So we kind of are a rounding error in terms of our population. So it may not come up on your radar screen. But I want to take a look at this closely and see how we can elevate the issue of congestion on Highway 29 with some of your statistics.
So one of the reasons why we built this website is because there are hundreds of stories right across the region, and we can never, as a regional agency, try to tell them all at once. But by building these interactives, we allow you to look at your city trends and look at more localized issues in this interactive format. So with congestion, for example, we have 141 different congested corridors in the region, and we're going to be letting people explore those on this site. So you'll be able to go investigate what's happening on in your neck of the woods, just as someone in San Francisco or in the South Bay could as well.
Hi, I just want to say great job on this. My mind's already turning on, you know, how we could incorporate this into this type of data into presentations of the council. So I know in Redwood City this is very useful information, especially seeing the increases in ridership along the Caltrain corridor and seeing how that correlates with congestion in the area as well.
And we did build in a feature on the site where within 1 minute you can customize it for your city and export it, get it in a PowerPoint slide, and use the vital signs results. Yeah, so the question was, how, are there plans to look at private employee shuttles? So I know there's an ongoing project here at MTC that's going to be collecting data on those sort of shuttle operations over the coming year or so. Right now, we don't have that data available. But we are. It is incorporated in some of the census-collected data. So in terms of people reporting what mode of transportation they take to work, if you report you took a bus, like an employee shuttle, that's incorporated in those transit numbers that you saw for mode share. When it comes to the transit ridership, we don't have as good data on those private operators because they don't report to the federal government like all of our other systems do. So hopefully, you know, as this project evolves over the coming years, we can incorporate those sorts of additional data sets.
One additional data point we might want to take a look at over the next 3 years is to what extent, you know, overall the transportation system does a pretty good job of getting those mid-distance trips. So if you're traveling, at least in the peninsula, you're traveling from San Francisco to Redwood City, you could take Caltrain, things like that. But those kind of shorter term, we've been talking to Lyft and other companies about how we can incorporate Lyft Line and Uber Pool into it to capture some of the get two or three employees to come into the major employment centers at the same time. And a lot of these companies are already talking to them to see how ride sharing could come into play. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in the next 3-4 years.
Just wondering, it seems like there's a lot of measures for car congestion. Wondering if you're also going to be looking at transit congestion, so overcrowding issues, which could be a contributing factor to the per capita decline.
So when we started off the project, that we had a large universe of measures we wanted to explore, and we've gotten it down to the 40 to 50 that we have today, which is already a pretty heavy lift for us. We would certainly like to look at transit congestion and the crowding issues. The question is, does it meet the 4 key criteria that we use to evaluate something and whether it can be a vital signs measure? And one of those is there a data set on that, a regional data set on crowding? Right now, there isn't something like that, but perhaps in the future, if that data is available, we can really do and dig into that analysis and include that sort of measure in vital signs.
Dave, I have a question. How do you see this information being used kind of over time on the Plan Bay Area? In other words, we could start the project when it was originally done, kind of what are the baseline conditions and what are our projections, and then measuring kind of over time. Do you see that this being used to do that or scenario analysis at all? Or?
Well, first of all, we plan on updating the site annually as we go forward. We get new data, make sure that that's available. But we want to use this as really just a baseline so everyone knows where we've been, and it should help to inform the discussion as we launch into the Plan Bay Area update.
I think that's right. I'll just add, you know, picking up on the transit piece, Eric's comment about some of the work going on the peninsula, there's a number of implementation projects that are underway right now. One of them in the South Bay is called the Core Connectivity Transit Study, and it's really looking at, with BART being extended to San Jose, Caltrain electrification and so forth, in that part of the region that was growing so rapidly and was very auto-dependent, through the early decades that it was growing, both in terms of office parks and also the types of homes, how would these new transit systems, do we address this last mile issue, which has been pretty vexing in a lot of the region? Core capacity is looking at BART, Muni, AC Transit, some of the core transit systems in the San Francisco-Oakland part of the region where transit crowding is an issue. And I think, you know, we're kind of at a point in time where, on the one hand, there's a lot of issues that are moving quite quickly that look very different than they did when the plan was first started
5 years ago. A lot more job growth, a lot more transit ridership on some of our key systems. Transit crowding is a real issue on some of our systems. And we'll be attempting to address those. But I think we want to be careful that we recognize that this Plan Bay Area is a long-range plan, and it encompasses a growth pattern that's really quite different than the growth pattern that led to some of these transit declines in earlier decades when, you know, the suburbs were really exploding and couldn't be served well by transit. That's a very different growth pattern than we have in the plan. And so we'll definitely use it as part of the dialogue going forward, but we don't want to look at, you know, data that's from 20 years ago in a different growth pattern or data from the last 2 years that looks very different and say, okay, that leads to a conclusion. I think it'll be part of the discussion.
Can you speak to us about the multilingual applications for your website and if you have any training proposed to help the underserved communities utilize your website?
This was an issue that was brought up at the Policy Advisory Council, and as I mentioned at that time, we're built in a multilingual support into the website. In fact, we've expanded that based off of the comments from the Policy Advisory Council. The translation feature that's built in actually allows folks to see the site in over 50 different languages, and it even automatically translates the interactives for them. So it's I think it's a pretty good feature that's going to help folks who are not English speakers. So we're not actually going out to communities to showcase this site. Our main strategy to get the word out is we're going to be doing press releases. We're going to have a launch event, really try to get the word out on social media, those sorts of avenues.
And thank you very much for expanding.
Any other questions? All right, well, thank you.
Thank you all very much. That'll do it for today. The next Regional Advisory Working Groups are going to be scheduled the first Tuesday at 9:30 in this room going forward. So the next one is February 3rd at 9:30, and we'll be sending out an agenda in advance of that meeting. And thanks again for coming. We really appreciate your input.